outbrightinternational.org/Ukraine. Hello from the employees of the Commonwealth Club. Before we begin, we want to take a moment to acknowledge the international crisis taking place in Ukraine and highlight an organization providing humanitarian assistance to people living in or fleeing Ukraine because of the war. Outright Action International is an organization dedicated to fighting for the human rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, and queer people everywhere. In response to the Russian invasion, Outright established a Ukraine fund to support local partners in Ukraine and neighboring countries who are providing emergency assistance to LGBTIQ people in need of safe shelter, food, medical care, transportation for those fleeing the country, and other types of humanitarian support. Because mainstream humanitarian systems too frequently leave LGBTIQ people behind. We encourage you to learn more about how to support Outright's important work by visiting outbrightinternational.org/Ukraine. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live stream audience and all those of you who watch later on YouTube. This is one of over 700 programs we have done at the Commonwealth Club by live streaming since the pandemic began. And today we have Matthew Continetti, who has written the book on the right. I don't want to call it the book quite yet. about the last 100 years of conservatism in America, starting with pretty much with Calvin Coolidge and running right through to Donald Trump. And all the different strands of the conservative thought, how they come together at times, how they split apart at other times. A very interesting study. Thank you very much for joining us, Matthew.
Well, thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
So my first question for you is, trying to condense, which you did very nicely, all that history with a lot of references to all the different resources, all the different magazines, all the different organizations that made up the background, the apparatus of the conservative, as William Buckley said, we don't have one. So that's a lot of work. So how long did it take you to put all that stuff together? And when did you conceive of this idea and start working on it?
Well, I really began an intensive research and study of the history of the right shortly after the 2012 election. Because I was puzzled by the results. And I was also fascinated by the divergences between the Washington Republicans and how they interpreted their loss in 2012, and then the grassroots populists and how they saw things after 2012. And so I've thought that the best way to look into the election would be to go back into the past. And so I began writing and reading about the history of the American right. I began teaching it in right around 2016. And then the book, of course, is released in 2022. It's really, I'd say, between six to 10 years of thinking and researching and writing and teaching about this material before we finally produced this book. And I'll call it the book on the American right.
Okay.
You don't have to, George. I'll call it that.
You go ahead.
Yeah. Authorial privilege.
The theme that you have, or one of the many themes, the theme that you have is that different parts of what can be considered the conservative coalition and how that has come together and fallen apart over time. Some parts of the conservative coalition consider other parts of it unruly or illegitimate or difficult, all of which different parts are. And I find it fascinating that both the intellectual wing of the conservatives and the populist wing of the conservatives kind of mirror the exact same wings of other parties and other organizations and everything, that there is a reaction against the people who do the thinking in general. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that. Why is it that the thinkers can almost never be the ones who are popular? There are exceptions, but very, very rarely does the thinker make it to be the popular leader.
Right. Well, I guess the simplest way to think about this is to think that there are men and women of ideas, and then there are men and women of action. And one of the themes of this book is, how do ideas get translated into action? What are the mediums by which ideas are communicated to people? How do the ideas find the right advocates and institutions? And then what do those advocates have to do in order to turn an abstract idea into a concrete policy and see it implemented? And so in the case of the American right, this process took, in some cases, generations. If you think about the libertarian thinkers I discuss in the book, many of them had very principled arguments for individual liberty and critiques of central planning and socialist economies that they wrote at a theoretical level. And then it really took figures like Milton Friedman to say, well, here are some practical policies that governments can institute to enhance human freedom and choice. But then, of course, it took a series of events and advocates like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan to actually see those policies into action. So it is a multi-stage process by which an idea becomes a reality. And it's also a contested process. One of the things I try to do in the book is show that nothing is inevitable. Historical events are contingent, and so much depends on the right person finding the right set of circumstances and the ideas that that person truly believes in, and how he or she can make those ideas a reality.
Well, the Commonwealth Club was founded on exactly that idea, to discuss ideas. And it was founded in 1903 in order to discuss among the people and create papers on how California was misgoverned, and to make policy suggestions. Well, we've been more of a talk shop for a long time, but the idea is to get as many ideas out as possible so that people can think about them, and people who are going to possibly put them into action do so. So we're continuing with that. It was very interesting the way you laid up the original part. We won't spend a lot of time on the Coolidge years and so on, but it's very clear that history essentially told the conservatives that they were wrong about two big issues, you know? So why don't you talk about that, the Depression and the war, and how it just pretty much put an end to a certain way of looking at things. Yeah.
Well, so in the 1920s, the Republican Party under Presidents Harding and Coolidge really repudiates the progressive vision of government, which prior to the 1920s had been floating really in both parties. Theodore Roosevelt identified as a progressive, even though he was a very popular Republican president. Woodrow Wilson, of course, a progressive Democratic president. In the 1920s, under Harding and Coolidge, the Republican Party really defines itself against progressivism, and it stands for what it calls Americanism, or normalcy in the case of Harding's famous coinage. And the Republican Party was very successful in the 1920s. Its combination of policies of non-intervention, immigration restriction, protectionism, but also a belief in what they would call free enterprise within the domestic market of the United States, delivered economic prosperity throughout the 1920s. Mm-hmm. However, with the onset of the Great Depression, with the stock market in 1929, and then perhaps more importantly, the bank crises of the 1931 and the collapse of the world credit system, the connection between Republicans and prosperity was severed. Mm-hmm. So the Republican economic policies were delegitimized. Right. Mm-hmm. Then meanwhile, throughout the 20s and 30s, the right in America believed in a policy of non-intervention, non-entanglement, very skeptical of having the United States join multilateral organizations like the League of Nations, also very wary of becoming too involved in the great power politics of Europe. Mm-hmm. But with World War II and the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, that aspect of the right was delegitimized as well. So coming out of the Second World War, the American right really had to fashion itself once again and figure out how to reestablish its credentials, both in the economy and in foreign policy.
two of the characters who weren't politicians, but they were very influential, sort of more like the Rush Limbaugh over their time, were Father Coughlin and Charles Lindbergh. You talk about that in a little bit more detail in the book, but it was very interesting to me that their influence was more or less shattered by World War II, that it put an end to their influence, and they just, you know, that maybe not the day it started, but within, mm-hmm. in a short amount of time after that, that they, neither one of them were being paid attention to.
Yes, well, in the case of Father Coughlin, it was actually his superiors within the Catholic Church who mm-hmm. told him to basically stop. And there was also some issues with the government and his publication that limited his reach. And so the Coughlin phenomenon, which was huge in its reach at its height, mm-hmm. Tens of millions of listeners, really dissipated. With Lindbergh, the famous aviator who was the primary spokesman for the America First Committee, America First basically closed its doors after Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. So it took the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor to really kind of shake America and enrage America enough to become involved in the war. America declaring war on Japan, and then Germany declaring war on the United States, mm-hmm. so making it a two-theater war. You know, I see similar echoes, faint echoes, in some of the reception to Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine mm-hmm. Over the past few months. Prior to that invasion, you saw a lot of discussion, including in some sectors of the American right, about how Vladimir Putin was a champion of national sovereignty and a leader in the global crusade for traditional values. And really, he was the aggrieved party here. As soon as those tanks started rolling over the border into Ukraine, however, a lot of those voices on the right became a little muted. And the American public opinion, just as a whole, is firmly behind Ukraine.
Yes, and that was exactly where I was going with that analogy. I was wondering if you thought that this is what's going to happen on the right for the support of Putin as a leader of that kind of thing. So that's what I think is going to happen, too. Very interesting when you support some. I mean, there's plenty of times on the other side of the political spectrum in the left when, you know, Stalin's actions slowly ate away at the support for communism among many people in the 1930s until the information came out so strongly that, boom, you know, it was pretty hard to be a Stalinist after that. So there's always something you tried. You make a comparison between Putin and national populism and on the right and Che Guevara on the left for right. left-wingers. And I thought that was very interesting. Why do you think, in both cases, why do you think that those individuals got that popularity? Because neither one seems to have, not say deserved it, but.
Well, that idea comes from a right-leaning thinker named Christopher Caldwell, who in 2017, as I write in my book, delivered a speech entitled How to Think About Vladimir Putin mm-hmm. To an audience associated with Hillsdale College in mm-hmm. Michigan. And in that speech, Caldwell described Putin as a champion of nationalism against globalism. And so he had become an iconic figure, similar to Guevara was for revolutionary socialism, someone who whose visage, you know, could appear on a t-shirt mm-hmm. And it'd be instantly recognized for standing for a certain set of political principles. I don't think that ever really took on as much in the American scene mm-hmm. As maybe in some European nations where prior to the invasion of Ukraine, Putin really was seen as, you know, kind of a leader who represented more than just his country. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you just look at the recent French presidential election, I think Macron effectively used Marine Le Pen's connections and words to Putin against her. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that parts of the American right in the last decade or so have wanted to see a strongman-like figure lead the American right and lead the Republican Party, someone who represents perceived masculine values, you know, like the images of Putin on the horseback without a shirt and all that, you know, a strong guy who's going to be tough and fight for his supporters and also maybe his country more broadly. That type of parallel really was visible, continues to be visible in some cases, but it was never really connected to Putin directly, though in some cases, of course, you could see it. And there was some evidence during the Trump years that Republicans were becoming more favorable to Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. But I think that has stopped or has slowed since Ukraine.
Yeah. All right. So let's go back to World War II. Well, before we go there, you had a little vignette about the Veterans Bonus Army in 1932. And what I found interesting were the three military leaders that were involved. This was the 1930s. So why don't you tell that? Because that was not expected.
Well, yes, no, it's an interesting little detail of history is that when the Bonus Army marched on Washington, basically, these were veterans who were demanding the pensions from World War One, mm-hmm. and they came to march in Washington during the Hoover, the final year of the Hoover administration, and they basically encamped. It was kind of like an Occupy Wall Street situation. Mm-hmm. It was an Occupy Anacostia, I believe there. That part of D.C. is where they set up shop, and the military came in to clear the camp, and the generals, or they weren't generals then, but they included figures like MacArthur, Patton, and Eisenhower, all involved in this clearance operation. So a little interesting piece of trivia that I, when I came across it, thought would make a deserved inclusion in my story as well.
Yeah, absolutely, because I mean, I've read a lot about all three of those guys, and no one ever mentions that they were involved in that. Of course,
It was a PR debacle, actually.
Yeah.
It played, I think, a part in Hoover's loss in 1932.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, you know, ever since Cyrus the Great, you don't play with the pensions of your soldiers, you know, or you get in trouble.
Yes. And it's another lesson, too, that I think conservatives have always struggled with, which is that once a government entitlement is introduced, it is very hard to take it away.
Yeah.
Because people feel that it is a deserved benefit, that they are owed it. I mean, that's why we call it an entitlement. Mm. But they will not give it up easily.
No. And it doesn't matter how you describe it intellectually to their, you know, it's right. Not even in their self-interest. Doesn't make any difference. So World War II was a big shift for all kinds of reasons, but it put an end to the leadership of the conservative movement and changed the argument. And then there was a focus now on anti-communism after the war. Interesting, mm-hmm. because the Soviet Union had been our partner during the war, but still. That became the new focus. And at that time, some new leaders started to show up on the conservative scene. Mm-hmm. And the first group were thinkers, mostly. Well, there was the populist Joe McCarthy. But why don't you tell about the 50s? People talk about the Eisenhower years as this kind of calm experience and stuff like that. But it was, again, problematic in the conservative movement because different parts of it were all doing their thing. And Eisenhower was not hardly considered a conservative.
No.
Certainly not by the John Birch Society.
or by the founders of the post-war conservative movement, which is, right. You know, kind of an irony of this history because Eisenhower considered himself a small C conservative, mm-hmm. someone who was basically for a slow approach to change. Mm-hmm. He's someone who stood for, a religion in the public square, for traditional values, for military strength. And yet so many of the leaders of the post-war conservative movement, self-conscious conservative movement, really opposed Eisenhower. So the question is why? Well, in the aftermath of World War II, the beginning of the Cold War, the rise of Soviet power, the debates really involved, do we attempt to contain communism with the Truman policy, Democratic President Harry Truman, or do we try to roll it back? Mm-hmm. So is it a difference? Do we try to contain communism to a certain geographic area and apply pressure, as George Kennan famously urged in his article in Foreign Affairs, that eventually the system would collapse? Mm-hmm. Or do we take an aggressive approach of confrontation with the aim of actually rolling back and defeating the communist system? Mm-hmm. Well, Eisenhower, his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, had made some more rollback comments early on. Mm-hmm. By the time the Eisenhower administration really settles in, Eisenhower continues the policy of containment. Mm-hmm. And this angers a lot of figures on the right, like the founders of the post-war conservative movement, who wanted rollback. Mm-hmm. And moreover, the right, throughout the 1930s and 40s, defined itself against Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Mm-hmm. So if a conservative is always kind of rises up in defense of an institution against a revolutionary challenge, the right in the 1930s thought that the institutions they were defending was the American Constitution and free enterprise system against what they saw as the revolutionary challenge of FDR and the New Deal. Mm-hmm. So these post-war conservatives wanted to roll back the New Deal just as they wanted to roll back communism abroad. But Eisenhower, of course, very famously and importantly, does not attempt that. He maintains the New Deal as he maintains containment. And this, I think, caused the post-war conservatives to really fashion their identities in opposition to Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. So it's a strange, at first it may seem strange that this happened considering he was a popular Republican president. But when you look into it a little bit more closely, you see what exactly they were reacting to. Mm-hmm. The goals of those post-war conservatives were to roll back the New Deal, mm-hmm. to get the government back to where it was prior to FDR's election, and to defeat communism abroad. But what was interesting, though, was those two positions really put the post-war conservatives kind of on the fringes of American politics and society in the 1950s.
It's interesting that, you know, conservatives are supposed to try to keep the institutions in place, basically, but it depends on how old you are, probably, as to what institutions you want to keep in place, right? How far back do you go? This is what I want to have. You know, I want to get back to what it was like when I was a child. And the older you get, the further, more work you have to do to undo whatever happened in the meantime. So, because I think almost everybody would think of Eisenhower as a relatively conservative and not inactive president, but you know, he didn't try to change a lot of things. And into this whole mix, not only was the McCarthy issues, but how Richard Nixon got his start on that thing. And was he conservative or not? I mean, he eventually was considered not conservative enough either. So why don't you tell about how Richard Nixon got his start? Because and why did he end up being, at such a young age, the vice president to Eisenhower?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's important to understand just the role of anti-communism in the formation of the post-war conservative movement. And the movement was shaped by ex-communists in a lot of ways. And perhaps one of the most significant ex-communists to influence the post-war conservative movement was a man by the name of Whitaker Chambers. Mm-hmm. Chambers had been a communist in the 1930s. In fact, he had been a spy, part of a spy ring for the Soviet Union. And in 1948, before the House Un-American Activities Committee, he charges that a well-known lawyer in Washington who had been part of the FDR governments during the New Deal era, named Alger Hiss, had also been part of the spy ring, mm-hmm. in which Chambers participated. And this launched a national scandal, a huge controversy, kind of the O.J. Simpson trial of its day between 1940 and 1950. And one of the players in the investigation, and both in the House and then later in the trial was a then freshman congressman, Richard Nixon, mm-hmm. who really became known as an anti-communist leader and a defender of Whitaker Chambers against Alger Hiss. And so Nixon's anti-communist positions, I think, made him attractive to Eisenhower as a potential running mate, because Eisenhower was coming in to the picture in 1952 with very little political experience. I mean, you know, you can't be the supreme commander of NATO and, you know, the leader of the alliance that defeated Hitler and not have political skill, right? And that's the thing. That's why people continue to kind of misjudge Eisenhower. But in the partisan terms, it was unclear where Eisenhower actually stood, especially on domestic matters. I mean, his expertise was in foreign policy.
Both parties asked him to run for president.
Exactly. And he defeated for the nomination in 1952. Kind of the leader of the old American right, Senator Robert Taft, mm-hmm. who was the son of a former president himself, but a senator from Ohio, and a leader in that kind of non-interventionist, protectionist right, mm-hmm. Who had run several times for the Republican nomination, but he never got it. So Eisenhower wants to kind of shore up his connections with the anti-communist wings of the GOP. And that led him to pick Nixon to be his running mate in 1952. Of course, that was not an unproblematic choice, famously because of the Nixon, the so-called slush fund that was discovered that, mm-hmm. Nixon had to address the nation in the Checkers speech to preserve his place in the ticket. It is interesting, as I tell this lengthy story about Whitaker Chambers and Richard Nixon, how much of my book is actually tied up with Nixon, mm-hmm. and his political career, because he arrives pretty early in my story, mm-hmm. in 1946, and of course carries on through his resignation in 1974, and then in some ways he lingers even after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his You make a comment about the 1960 election, which I thought was cleverly worded, by the way, where you say that Nixon saw JFK's dirty tricks, but decided to not contest the election.
Yes.
Now, the reason, I mean, for those of you who are very young, dirty tricks was exactly what Nixon was known for. So the fact that you turned it around and put it on Kennedy was kind of cute.
Well, so did Nixon. Yeah. Whenever Nixon was accused of a dirty trick, he of course would launch into a monologue about how Kennedy and especially Lyndon Johnson had perfected them prior to him.
Yeah, he learned from the mentors. Yeah, and the other thing for those who don't. Haven't read that part of history. Nixon and Kennedy were actually pretty good friends and colleagues in the House of Representatives. They both started around the same time, right?
And then in the Senate.
Yeah, too. And then in the Senate.
They did have a relationship. And in that 1960 election, it is interesting, the differences between the parties were pretty blurred. Mm-hmm. And in fact, on some aspects, Kennedy campaigned as a more aggressive anti-communist, mm-hmm. than Nixon, who was part of, despite having a wealth of foreign policy experience during the Eisenhower administration, was a defender of the, and continued to be even when he became president, of a more restrained foreign policy, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is the Kennedy that, of course, in his first year and in his inaugural, you know, discusses kind of the willingness to pay any burden, mm-hmm. bear any burden, pay any price to defend liberty, mm-hmm. Kind of a challenger of the Soviet Union. So there is evidence of some skullduggery during that 1960 campaign, mm-hmm. but unlike the most recent Republican president, Nixon does not turn it into an issue. In fact, as vice president, presides over the electoral vote count. Mm-hmm. I think that's that's a lesson in humility from a figure that we don't necessarily look to for lessons, right?
Yeah,
considering the way his story ended up.
Yeah, you talk about, when talking about Nixon, you talk about how difficult this was for younger people during the war and stuff like that. And since I'm of that age, I thought I'd throw in. I think what the big difficulty was the fact that everybody who was, 16 and older, not everybody, but large numbers of people, knew that LBJ and Nixon, it wasn't a partisan thing, but that LBJ and Nixon had both been lying about what was going on, and were frustrated that their parents didn't catch on, and that their parents did not buy that argument. And it was, in a way, it was too close to World War II in their experience, and their experience was, yes, not everything was completely clear during the war. There was lots of opaqueness, but the inherent just reasons for governmental action during World War II were assumed that that would continue, and Eisenhower didn't really do anything to upset that during the time before. Whereas then, people just made that assumption. But you said it about Nixon, because at the time, I remember someone saying to me, anybody would be a better president than Nixon. And I said, anybody would be better than him? He said, anybody in the whole country would be a better president. And I said, have you ever watched the president of your local PTA at work? Because that would tell you that 97% of the people would do a worse job than Nixon, no matter what he's doing. And so it was a difficult time for not seeing things in terms of, oh, we've been lied to. Everyone assumes that the government now, and has for a long time, lies some of the time, if not more than 50% of the time. And so it was a big difference. I think that was the big emotional problem that broke the generation or caused that generation gap at that time, was that the young people accepted that they were being lied to or at least believed that they were being lied to, and their parents did not.
There was a collapse in trust for sure, because of Vietnam. There was, of course, many more casualties, American casualties, not to mention the Vietnamese casualties,
right,
because of our involvement there. Tens of thousands of soldiers killed. There was the draft, mm-hmm, right? And then right, there was also corruption associated with the draft if you right, got out of it, or, when I look at the story I tell in the book, mm-hmm, Vietnam is a pivotal period because of its effect on the Democratic coalition and its effect on liberalism. Mm-hmm. Basically, the Democratic coalition comes apart, opening the way for Nixon's return, mm-hmm, as president and his comeback in 1968. And it also affects the intellectual circles, mm-hmm, the counterculture, the anti-war movement, changes in the nature of the civil rights movement and the agenda of the civil rights movement in the late 1960s are all instrumental in pushing a group of anti-communist liberals to the right and to the Republican Party. And those become the first wave of what come to be known as neoconservatives. Right. So hugely important. And then I would say, too, when I look back at the last 20 years, I think you can look at the war in Iraq as having a similar effect on the American right, mm-hmm, as the war in Vietnam had on the American left.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to what came after Nixon, I want to go to Goldwater for a second, because mm-hmm, he was quite influential in a way that people don't realize, because he lost so badly to LBJ. And I think one of the things that you show, he's known as an extremist and all that, because that's how he was painted. But, you have a couple of stories in your book, which I also have read before, about his stand on certain issues was quite not so extreme. There was this John Birch Society, which is another thing to explain, because I think that also helps explain where the Tea Party itself, because it's not exactly the same at all, but where different populist movements on the conservative right are aligned with that. And the John Birch Society was known as being extreme and extremist. And the leader wrote a book that claimed that Ike was part of the communist conspiracy. And Goldwater said to him, you know, well, you can tell the story.
Burn the book. They said, this is trash. don't let anybody see this. It's going to ruin us all. That's what Barry said. Barry Goldwater had a very acerbic personality, you know, and he wasn't afraid to say something kind of, I wouldn't say even outlandish, but he spoke his mind and he didn't really care what people thought. I mean, a quality you see in many political figures and you definitely see in Goldwater. Yes, the John Birch Society was a mass member, anti-communist grassroots organization, starts in the late 1950s, really becomes popular in the early 1960s. It's a weird organization in the sense that it's secretive, mm-hmm. so you don't know the exact membership, and it's also structured in such a way that it's top-down. Mm-hmm. So the message and the activities are controlled through its leader, Robert Welch, who is a former candy magnet, produced candy bars, but was also an anti-communist and a conspiracist. Mm-hmm. As you say, he believed that Eisenhower was part of the communist plot. This was just a crazy idea. And it became a problem for the conservative movement because conservatives wanted to attain power within the Republican Party. They wanted to get a platform where they could advocate for their positions, which were developing with all this intellectual activity, their proposals, which were becoming more concrete. And they couldn't find their way into the center of the American political conversation if they were associated with conspiracies and extreme beliefs like in the John Birch Society. So it became a very complicated process of disentangling conservatism from the John Birch Society and its conspiracy theories. Goldwater, even though he knew that this was the wrong thing, he kind of ended up getting kind of caught up in this morass of his famous line in his 1964 acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention at the Cow Palace, where he says, "Let me remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice," was very controversial. And I tell a story in the book that a friend of mine was there watching the speech as it happens, and he's overheard one reporter say to another after that line was uttered, the reporter said to his friend, "Dear God, he's going to run as Barry Goldwater," knowing that at that time in 1964, Goldwater's ideas were just not considered mainstream in many ways. But the other saying that I like to quote comes from George Will, who said that, Barry Goldwater won the 1964 election. It just took 16 years to count the votes because you can trace a line between Goldwater's defeat in 1964 mm-hmm. and Ronald Reagan's victory in 1980. And of course, Ronald Reagan makes his national political debut with his speech, A Time for Choosing, that airs on television with about a week to go in the 1964 campaign. Mm-hmm. And clearly, once that speech aired, people immediately began urging Reagan to run for governor of California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about Reagan then, because it's a perfect transition. You had a great quote. He ran against Berkeley almost, when he was running for governor. Yes. And one of his lines, which you quote, was that the campus radicals look like Tarzan, have hair like Jane, and smell like cheetah.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, it's a great line. But second of all, it shows the way he used movies and pop culture to make comments, which he did all the time, which is a big part of his appeal.
Yeah.
Pop culture, he tied politics into pop culture, and he was a movie star.
We
talk about the conservative movement and the ideas, and we've been talking about that. Well, one of the things that's fascinating is that two of the biggest influential conservatives, totally different kinds of conservative, mm-hmm. are people with outsized personalities or personalities that people find influential. And Richard Nixon, when you describe Richard Nixon, such a well-read man, so always thinking about what he was doing, always strategizing about what he was doing, but failing as a personality, as a leader. Do you know what I mean? LBJ also so good at, I mean, this is not conservative, but LBJ is so good at making things happen in the Senate and the Congress, mm-hmm. but not able to project a personality that made him a leader that people would be willing to listen to in a way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting point. I would say with Nixon, you know, if you had asked in January of 1973, people would say, wow, things really are working out for Richard Nixon. He just won this landslide victory, finally people, you know, he's getting what he wanted. He had signed the Paris Peace Accord. And of course, that underneath the surface was Watergate, which was building the break-in that happened in June of 72. But how he handled that, of course, I think has led many people to reevaluate what had come before in his presidency, which are actually, whether you agree with them or not, pretty significant achievements. I mean, the most perhaps consequential in world history was his visit to China and his recognition of China in 1972. I would say on Reagan too, I take a slightly more complicated view, which is that there's no question that Reagan's personality was unique and compelling and did so much to bring conservatism into the mainstream of American life, bring conservatism into power with his election in 1980. At the same time, Ronald Reagan was much smarter than he may have wanted people to think. Mm-hmm. And if you go read his diaries, or if you read his correspondence, or if you read some of those radio addresses he gave during the wilderness years after he left the governor's office and before the 1980 campaign, he had the 1976 campaign in the middle there. But he was a consumer of all of the intellectual products that the post-war conservative movement was putting out. So he read National Review. He was friends with National Review's editor, William F. Buckley Jr., the founder of the post-war conservative intellectual movement. He was a subscriber to a newsletter called Human Events, which was a long-running Washington conservative newsletter. It's actually quite funny. I don't know if I tell this story in the book, but he continued to receive all these publications while he was president, and he would often read an article in them and call up his advisors. And it got to the point where his aides, Michael Deaver and James Baker, would try to hide the latest copy of Human Events from President Reagan because they didn't want him to see something that would send them down a rabbit hole, or they thought, you know, considered a rabbit hole. So I it's actually really striking when you study Reagan, as I have for this book. Mm-hmm. And I say in the book, the consistency of his beliefs is really striking. I mean, he kind of comes onto the scene in a political sense in 1947. He talks to the House Un-American Activities Committee in his capacity as president of the Screen Actors Guild. And he gives an interview to Hedda Hopper, the Hollywood gossip columnist, mm-hmm. after his testimony. And he talks about in that interview the importance of freedom, mm-hmm. of democracy, of American exceptionalism, of a bright future. Of course, his opposition to communism as something that just kind of squelches humankind's creative spirits. Mm-hmm. And of course, these themes are reflected in all of his speeches up mm-hmm. to his final address at the 1992 Republican convention, his last mm-hmm. major speech. That view of the world never changed. Mm-hmm. And the principles never changed, but he was very good also at relating those principles to concrete issues. Mm-hmm. And so an unusual thing about Reagan's speeches, and in fact, something that, say, Peggy Noonan, his famous speechwriter, writes that she often struggled with, is Reagan always wanted to put details in the speeches, mm-hmm. statistics, you know, that actually what would come across as quite boring, numbers and facts and figures. But when related through Reagan's persona, with that, you know, with his bearing and with his baritone voice, mm-hmm. and that glint in his eye actually made the speech come alive. So you're right about the importance of personality, but I would say too, personality with ideas is not going to get you very far.
Right, right.
You need both.
Then you can stay a movie star.
Right, yes. Yeah. Or a reality TV
show. Or a reality TV, yeah, exactly. the interesting thing, too, is the timing. You said he got started in 47. It was 1980, 33 years later when he won the election. And he had definitely tried in 76 to beat Ford. Mm-hmm. And as you said, he made famous in 64 when the Goldwater thing. But his timing was perfect in 1980 because, you know, Jimmy Carter was saying, you know, America is washed up. I mean, that's the way it looked. And for him to come in with this sunny humor, a lot of people didn't like what he said. Yeah. But after he got shot, shortly after he started, even though the people didn't like what he said, I mean, the people who disagree with him from a political point of view, it was hard not to like him. It was hard not to like him because he made jokes as he was going in after he got shot and about to die. And I mean, he could have died. It wasn't a lighthearted shooting. You know, it was a serious shooting.
So, yeah, no. And he famously told the doctors as he was going into surgery, I hope you are all Republicans.
Right.
Exactly. And then just an amazing historical figure, is someone who, like Nixon, is endlessly fascinating, but in different ways. Yeah. Yes, Reagan was always more personally popular than his policies,
right?
Which actually, from the other party's perspective, you also saw with President Obama.
Right.
President Obama is always much more personally popular than what he stood for. With Reagan, too, in that 1980 year, you're right, the world just seemed to be coming apart. Because mm-hmm. you had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. You had the Iranian hostage crisis and the failure to rescue the hostages in Desert One. You had stagflation. Mm-hmm. So you had bracket creep. And Reagan presented an alternative at an election that was going to be a change election. And you're right how he deflected the concerns about his conservatism in that one debate with Jimmy Carter in 1980. He just he used that famous line, you know, there you go again. Yeah. Right. And by the time he kept using that line, he had defeated Carter. Carter didn't know how to respond to it. It's quite similar, you know, just going up to 1984 and talking about Reagan's reelection briefly. There were two debates that year. In the first debate against Walter Mondale, the Democratic nominee who had been Carter's vice president, like most incumbent presidents during the era of presidential debates, Reagan did not do well in the first debate. Mm-hmm. And this is something that happened with Barack Obama, something that happened obviously with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. It happened with George W. Bush in 2004. Mm-hmm. So there were real concerns that Reagan may have cost himself the election with that first debate performance because, you know, there were always concerns about Reagan's age. At the time of his election, he was the oldest president. To date.
He's
average. Yeah. Cause then Trump surpassed Reagan and then Biden surpassed Trump.
Right.
But so how does Reagan get out from out of this hole? Well, of course his famous line in the 1984 debate is, he goes, you know, I will not make age an issue in this campaign. I will not talk about my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Right.
And of course, Mondale is, you know, in his 60s at that point. And even Mondale laughs at the joke.
Yeah, sure.
And that was it. You know, the race is over.
Yeah, yeah. And very few political campaigners have used the joke so effectively, you know, in many ways, so many times. So we have maybe 10, 15 minutes left. So I want to cover the current period of time too.
Sure.
So we'll move right past Clinton and those years, which was a buildup of reaction to Clinton and all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. So it's always interesting in your book, what's going on behind the scenes that builds to what happens after what's going on. There's a lot of work being done. And of course, I think in any organization like that, where there's opposing viewpoints and people trying to take control, there's a lot of work going on, but it doesn't always work that you eventually get back into power again. But this work went on, and then George W. Bush got back into power. It was, you know, interesting that he got in after his father, who was, you know, a more well-known establishment figure. And but the son gets in, By the way, this is some just aside, but his father made Dan Quayle his vice presidential nominee, a very conservative young man. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered whether he was just doing that to lay the foundation for his son, George W. Bush, to run, because I thought they were fairly similar characters in many ways. Made everybody comfortable with Dan Quayle, then his son would have a chance. I don't know if he's strategized that clearly, but it sure seemed like it.
Yeah, because people really weren't comfortable with Dan Quayle.
No.
He was not the most popular vice president. Actually, again, I think the current vice president has a similar problem. Yeah. That's an interesting point. And I don't know whether HW had that in mind. Of course, W was involved in his father's presidential campaigns,
right?
80 as well as 88 and 92. And I think took some lessons from that. Also recognized when he was governor of Texas in the aftermath of his father's defeat, that he would need to include the right as part of his coalition, that he would need to make sure that the conservatives felt that he was one of them, or he was not hostile to them. And they did a lot of outreach, he and his chief advisor Karl Rove, to include the American conservative movement as part of their coalition when they went and came into power under very controversial circumstances, of course. The 2000 election and the recount. They came to power in 2001, but all of the ambitions of the Bush administration and the ideas of compassionate conservatism or a new Republican Party that was going to include Hispanics through the auspices of immigration reform, that really came to a halt with the attacks of 9/11.
Right.
And Bush became a war president, and for a time a very popular one, but nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
And by the end of his tenure, was a figure that despite his virtues, in my view, the Republican Party and the right felt they would have to move beyond in order to get back into power.
You mentioned in the book how 9/11 split the conservative movement back into its categories because they disagree with each other. So there's the neocons, neoconservatives. There were the America First, the Buchanan, the isolationist. And then there's the cultural issues. It's interesting in your book, some of the most famous from a writing point of view conservatives are the economic conservatives, that Milton Friedman, the so on.
Yeah.
But they never have any power. They influence some things, but they're never at the center of politics.
Yeah, probably Milton Friedman was the closest you get.
Yeah.
And it is interesting, as you look and you read Capitalism and Freedom, his major book, which came out in 1962, the ideas that he talks about in those books, that book, and then Free to Choose is the sequel in 1980, they, in many cases, are reality. When you think about school vouchers, monetary policy, though the monetary policy is strayed from what Friedman would want, negative income tax or the earned income tax credit. He definitely, I think, was among the American right, among American libertarians, the best at coming up with proposals that politicians could actually include as part of an agenda, including, by the way, Friedman was an advocate and one of the architects of the abolition of the draft, which happened under Nixon.
Right. So he influenced it with his ideas. That's a good example of what we were talking about before. What can you do with your ideas? But it just, you know, it seems like the economic group, even though the different other conservatives will agree with the conservative economic ideas, that's not really ever the political focus at an election. Okay? So
yes, that's not where the votes are.
Yeah.
Right? That's not where the votes are. Definitely where the votes are in the social issues.
Yeah.
And among religious voters, of whom there are many. Yeah.
So we know that had a big influence on Donald Trump's election, and we'll go back to that. But before we go back to that, it seems like we are about to have another wave of that this reaction, like family values, I don't know, you can call it all kinds of different things, but that people feel that the interests are too fringe again. and that the Democratic Party is interested in two fringe ideas instead of in the big substantive issues for the rest of the families, and that not paying attention to this is going to hurt them pretty badly at the election.
Yes. So. Yeah. I found in the history that I studied that the Republicans' greatest victories are the result of Democratic overreach. And conversely, Democrats score big when Republicans are seen as to be out of the mainstream.
Right.
Like, I mean, take the Goldwater example.
Right.
Or even take the 2020 election as an example. Mm-hmm. Even though Republicans down ballot did unexpectedly well, mm-hmm. I think Trump lost because moderates and independent voters in the suburbs were just tired of him.
Yeah.
They're just tired of the endless controversy. So you want to be associated with the mainstream in American politics if you want to maintain a majority. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the Biden administration is that Biden was elected on an anti-mandate. He was elected not to be Donald Trump, mm-hmm. but he became convinced that he was actually elected to be FDR and LBJ combined, and that he was going to do that with one of the smallest congressional majorities in a century, smallest House Democratic majority in a century, and a 50-50 Senate. Mm-hmm. And that set him up for frustration and failure. Mm-hmm. And also, it, I think, has hampered his ability to pivot to the center away from some of the program of the cultural left, which voters are rejecting when it comes to issues on criminal justice, when it comes to parental role in education, mm-hmm. And certainly when it comes to the economy. The electorate right now seems to be veering to the right and to the Republican Party. The problem, however, is I don't think the Republicans really have any sense of what they will do if they're given this power in November. And so the cycle of kind of overreach and frustration is sure to continue until one, the Democrats are able to reassert their identity as the party of the American middle class, which is how they've been historically successful over the last 30 years. Or two, the conservatives are able to somehow to synthesize ideas and a policy agenda with this populist grassroots revolt, which has only been building over the last 15 or so years.
I'm going to cover two more points, and then we'll get to the questions. Thanks a lot for all the questions that have been coming in for Matthew. So one thing is, you talk about the mainstream. And if you go back to the 60s, in 1960, you said the parties were very close to each other on a large number of issues. And, of course, that has not been true for a long time. And both parties have a populist wing on their extreme, basically. And I always wondered whether you couldn't get the more moderate, and I don't know where you would draw the line as to what moderate was, but the more moderate Democrats and the more moderate Republicans to just let their wings go off and join together. Because I think most of them would find it easier to deal with each other and come to compromises than to deal with the populist wings of their parties. But... you know, that's not going to happen. But it would seem like it would
it's
be
a nice spot,
for the
George. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
The politicians in the middle.
There are many politicians who would like that to happen. I mean, you do see things like the Problem Solvers Caucus in the House, for example. You know, where people are trying to come together. Look, this is America. We have a wide variety of opinion. It's a function of how free we are as a society. And we're actually having big arguments today over just how wide an opinion we can have, right? Yeah. And who gets to enforce the parameters in what venues over who talks. That seems to be occupying a lot of our politics today. And it's certainly true that I think as a function of technology and changes in the media, extreme points of view on the left and the right have more purchase. Mm-hmm. They're able to find followers, and they're able to get attention. And as I talk a little bit about in my book, I am a believer in this idea that we exist in an attention economy, mm-hmm. that the primary commodity is people's time. And if you can get their attention, mm-hmm. you have expressed some value, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you assert your value. And so the way you get attention these days is by being outlandish, mm-hmm. Sadly. So how we get through this is unclear. If I knew that, mm-hmm. I'd be probably a wealthier man. But I do think another lesson from my history is that we've seen this before.
Yeah.
There's really nothing new under the sun. Populism, extremism, internal dissent within these various movements, a contest for power. It's been going on certainly through the 100 years that I cover. And what that means is that, you know, there, even if the future looks bleak, there is always hope because we've been through similar circumstances and we've emerged and survived to this point.
Whenever the common enemy disappears, like communism, then all of the divisions inside the group that you were fighting, you know, they show up. And that was true for conservatives. It's true for the Democrats. As soon as they won this last election, all of their divisions showed up again, too.
Well, that's true. And, you know, you even see it with, as the Democrats struggle to find how they might push back this red wave, what they're deciding, oh, well, maybe if we talk about Trump, right? Yeah. Because Trump was a unifying force for them for 4 years. And he, of course, not in office. So it makes it harder to make that argument. But you're right. People are much more willing to agree on what they are against than what they are for. That's and of course, it's what they're for is actually what makes the biggest difference.
And that's why I always think that the human race will finally get together when the aliens actually do arrive.
Well, you know, Reagan said that, too. Reagan once said that. He said, you know, wouldn't it be great if the alien invasion could come so we would all know how much in common we have.
You have a quote from Novak, I think, one of your intellectual conservative writers, about socialism, which I thought was really great. He said that socialism is neither, in America, it's neither an economic program nor a political one. It is the remnant of Judeo-Christian beliefs in goodness and paradise on earth and sharing, a sharing economy. And I was wondering if you felt that that was said 30, 40 years ago or something like that, whether that accounts for the millennial interest in socialism and the number of people that are willing to vote for it. Because it does seem like they're not really asking to change too much of what it is. It's just let's all share things a little bit more. Or let's all, you know, and I thought it was an interesting argument because religion is not as prominent as part of how people identify themselves anymore. I mean, everyone knows about the identity issues now. The main identity issue in the 1950s and 60s is, you know, are you a Lutheran or a Methodist or this or that or another thing? And, you know, now people don't pay any attention. No, they pay attention to it, but it's not the issue. It's not a political issue anymore. And one other thing about the conservatives, kind of interesting that two of the big political figures, right, Reagan and Donald Trump, neither one fit the mold of family values and so on. They both divorced. A couple times in Donald's case, et cetera, et cetera. So it's fascinating that they were able to pull those strains and talk about it anyway.
Yes. I mean, on socialism, Michael Novak, the theologian and defender of American capitalism, I think made a very incisive point there where he talked about that socialism in some ways is a secularization of religious belief, that it's a community of brotherhood of man and such. Mm-hmm. And I think that does apply to younger generations today where you see the disaffiliation with religion, with the collapse in religious attendance. Mm-hmm. And socialism is a substitute there. On Reagan and Trump, you're right. I mean, Reagan was divorced once. Trump was divorced twice, which means the next advocate for the religious right will be divorced three times. I don't know who that is.
One of Donald's sons, I guess.
Maybe. I don't know. So why? Why then does the religious right embrace these figures who don't have much in common with them? I think it's the sense that they will be their champions. Mm-hmm. So that Reagan really took on many of the issues that the moral majority in the 1980 election voiced support for. He talked to them. He said that he would bring their agenda into the Oval Office. And it was the same with Trump. Even though many religious figures were leery of Trump early on, once the campaign got going, and then certainly once he came into office, he made sure that part of the coalition was always satisfied, and it paid political dividends for him and continues to.
You make a very interesting point in your book about Trump that if he had not supported the January 6th insurrection, to the extent that he did, whatever that amounts to in the end, that he would be known for having satisfied so many of the issues, especially the judicial issue and other things, and that he would have accomplished certain things, but that that's going to all be overshadowed by the insurrection.
Yes. I mean, that is my belief. That is how I view the Trump presidency. Yeah. I will say that in the year since I wrote those words, you know, there's always a lag time with the book production. I've been actually quite surprised at how little January 6th matters, in particular within the Republican Party. And so I think that Trump's stature in the Republican Party is still very high. You know, we'll see how far his reach goes in some of these upcoming primaries these next 2 months. But he remains the central figure in the Republican Party despite the events of January 6th. And I think that should give everybody pause. And they need to think through the fact that in many ways we are still living in the Trump era. It hasn't ended yet.
I'm sure Biden felt that way the first 6 months of his presidency because Trump was in the news more than he was, I think. So, so anyway, we do have some questions. We're nearly out of time, but I do want to ask a couple of them. One, Marlene Jones, just to ask Matthew, are you writing from a conservative, neutral, or liberal point of view?
Sure. Yeah, I am a conservative. I'm an American conservative. So I believe in the Constitution. I believe in the principles of the Declaration of Independence. I believe in the free market. And I believe in a strong America engaged in the world. Now, the principles that I just outlined to you are not necessarily the most popular in the Republican Party these days, or even on the American right. So so even though I write as a conservative and I am a conservative, I try to be as detached and as fair-minded as possible in my history. And so I think readers will find that for almost the entirety of the book, I take a scholarly approach. And then toward the both a little bit at the beginning and then a little bit further at the end, I kind of let my I voice my own views on some of these matters, in with regard to Trump in particular.
Yeah, and you use a couple of adjectives every once in a while that leaks the point of view.
Yes, that's the historian's prerogative. You know, make it interesting, right?
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
I just love a report. Yeah,
I love the one about Richard Nixon. You just referred to him as his premature exit from office. I thought that premature was very interesting.
Yeah. Well,
anyway, we'll end with one question from George Steffner. He has several questions, but they're all about the same thing. Is it the left wing's growing fanaticism that has created the right wing's growing fanaticism, or is it in the other direction? Basically, who do you think, or is it a spiral? You know, everybody inspired
each
other.
It's the left defashions the right. There wouldn't be a right without a left. You always need the rebellion in order to bring about people who want to defend the status quo or the inherited institutions. So that's 200 years of history right there,
right?
Since we had these categories. And I think progressive overreach during the Obama years only fueled the fires of populist revolt in this country. Mm-hmm. I think Obama often said in public that there was a fever on the Republican grassroots, and that his policies were meant to make the fever go away. Mm-hmm. I think he got it backwards. Mm-hmm. I think Obama's policies, as well as his personality, which was responsible for some of the backlash, but I think his policies only made the Republican grassroots more suspicious of elites, more distrustful of institutions, and more willing to embrace disruptors from outside the system like Donald Trump.
Well, that's great conservative advice to the left wing. You know, if you want the conservatives to argue among themselves and not have a big influence, what you should do is don't rebel against anything big. You know, don't give us a target. And you'll find that we'll be talking among ourselves. It's like American foreign policy in the Middle East sometimes is, you know, you make yourself the common enemy and it really is a big problem now. As you go back to what Reagan said about the aliens, the same thing. It's a crucial kind of issue in politics that runs all the way, not through only America's 200 years, but 5,000 years of human history. Don't make yourself the target.
Good advice.
Yeah. It came from you. So there we go. So thank you very much, Matthew, for, joining us at the Commonwealth Club in this, high-tech way. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club, and it's 120 years of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.